This is Web.Guys Radio, and thank you for joining us and listening. My name is Rob Greenlee.
And I'm Webgirl Dana, and we're here both together to bring you the inside peek into the future of the web and internet technology. You've heard of open source, you've heard of Linux and Unix, and of course, Windows. And you run a business and you're wondering what platform is best and most economical. Martin Fink will be joining us today. Martin Fink is the general manager of Hewlett-Packard's Linux Systems Division, where he's responsible for driving HP's Linux and open source strategy. But he's also the author of a book called The Business and Economics of Linux and Open Source. Basically a book that gives us a look into how Linux is an economically viable competitor to Windows and can be part of the business world.
Is Linux really free? Point really is that there's absolutely an opportunity to lower your overall cost by deploying Linux in your environment, but it's not free. And that's really the gap we have to get folks to understand, is that it is not free, but it can be significantly lower cost.
Well, we all wonder how we can save big bucks on our inkjet cartridge purchases, right? We'll talk with Larry Letard. He's the product manager at Strident Software, and they're the makers of a great solution for that, InkSaver. It's at www.inksaver.com. Larry agrees with us that those darn ink cartridges can cost more than the printers themselves, and we're going to hear from him about the printer industry's dirty little secrets that are robbing your pocketbook.
The printer industry is a huge industry. The projections are that by next year, there will be 115 million inkjet printers just in the U.S. Ink cartridge revenue is actually higher than that at this point. It's, I think, somewhere between $15 and $17 billion for this year. And so what you're seeing is that the manufacturers are getting those printers out there as inexpensively as they can so that they can capture the highly profitable inkjet cartridge money.
All that ahead for you here on Web.Guys Radio.
Some news from around the net this week. Music webcasters have more ammo in their fight. Major online content sites' ad sales are up. Rob?
Proponents of the notion that webcasting basically encourages CD sales now have a little more ammo in their fight out there. There was a study that came out from the Arbitron folks and the Edison Media Research Group that basically shows that heavy users of streaming media buy more than 50% more CDs than the average consumer. And that's good news, I think, for the streaming media industry and the power that that it really brings to the marketplace. An average of 21 CDs were purchased by streamies in the past year compared to a 13 for an average American. The RIAA, which kind of governs the music industry, has been insisting all along that the specialized radio stations on the web have been cutting into their member sales, and this research is really indicating that that's not necessarily the case.
But what's interesting is that the RIAA just praises radio airplay. They say that's the only way they could increase their CD sales. So what does it matter the method of delivery as long as the songs are heard and that sparks an interest?
Yeah, exactly. It's sampling is what's going on here, and people hear it more in the workplace or at home or wherever or in their cars. It really shouldn't matter. It produces the same benefit and increased sales.
There's a webcast coming up, Rob, ironically, about all this.
Yeah, on Thursday, September 5th, there's a, like Dana said, a free webcast that's going to be available from the Arbitron site as well as the Edison Research Group. And those two sites are arbitron.com or edisonresearch.com.
Well, you know that the big struggle with content sites on the web is how do they earn money? How do they earn revenues? Well, a lot of them, you know, zipped on over to the whole subscription model, New York Times, the Slate.com. Wondering if they could make it. The good news is Online Publishers Association reported that their sales were up by about 34% on the top 14 content sites on the web.
And also, in addition to that, the total revenue among this top 14 group increased about 36%. So this is a sign that content online has a future. It's just going to be with, I think, a fewer number of sites than probably what was originally thought during the dot-com boom. because most of the sites that are listed on in this survey are fairly large content sites like ESPN.com, FoodTV.com, Forbes.com, NewYorkTimes.com, Slate, you know, all of the big guys out there that are really aggregating a lot of the traffic and have big brands.
Well, WebTalk Guys has really good ad rates.
That's right.
I just thought I'd point that out. Contact us if you want to find out.
Hey, I'd also like to thank Sam and Vicky from California, Jerry from Florida, Robert from Oregon, and Cheryl from New Jersey, Bonnie from Arizona, Kim from Louisiana.
Rob, how do you know all these girls?
And these are just a few of the new members of our weekly email newsletter that goes out.
Oh, okay. I was wondering why you were thanking all these women, you know?
It's amazing. You know, we do have a lot of women sign up for our newsletter, and that's a terrific sign. I mean, if you look at our demographics, it's mostly men, but the seems to be changing.
You go, sisters.
Stay tuned, because up next we're going to talk about Linux and open source platforms and the business and economic side of the growing influence of the Linux platform. And we're going to be speaking with Martin Fink, who's the author of a new book on the business of Linux. So stay connected. This is Web.Guys Radio.
This is an Online Minute with Trey Hickman. He's president and founder of Nextology. Today we're talking about online content management made easy. Trey, how is Nextology making this possible?
Our online content management applications, such as Quick Editor, allow people, regardless of technical ability, to get involved in authoring, editing, and posting to the web.
Well, what about coding or HTML?
Nextology leaves the code in the design process, where it belongs. You can author and publish text, hyperlink, add graphics, and formatting in seconds without any coding.
Does a website need to be designed by Nextology to be edited with Quick Editor?
Not at all. Quick Editor retrofits any existing design, or it could be the foundation for brand new site development.
So it doesn't matter where it's hosted or who designed it?
That's exactly right, Dana. Say you're a developer. All of our web-based tools integrate seamlessly with your existing code and allow your clients the benefit of online content management.
Ah, thank you, Trey. Well, for more information about Quick Editor, visit www.nextology.com, where you can also sign up for Nextology's free monthly newsletter, Content Strategy News. For easy and affordable online content management, check out Nextology.
The Web Talk Guys, here and now.
This is Web Talk Guys Radio, and I'm Rob Greenlee, and thanks for listening.
And I'm Web Girl Dana. Rob, Linux has been a real powerful open source OS platform over the past few years. We've heard a lot about it. Yet the industry has struggled to really understand the business and economic side of the growing Linux influence within small and large companies.
To help us all understand, we invited Martin Fink, who is an author of The Business and Economics of Linux and Open Source, and he is also currently the general manager for Hewlett-Packard's Linux Systems Division, where he has been leading Linux development activities for more than 3 years. He's also responsible for driving HP's overall Linux and open source strategy and managing the firm's open source business processes. In his spare time, he's also vice president of the board of directors for the Open Source Development Lab, a global consortium of industry leaders dedicated to promoting Linux and Linux-based programming. Martin, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Is Linux really free?
Is Linux really free? The Linux operating system itself is something that you can either acquire from a number of different sources, like you can download from the internet.
Yeah.
You can't actually buy copies from folks like Red Hat and stuff. But the real issue of cost has to do with what is the cost to deploy this in my whole environment?
Sure.
And sometimes that's the part we have to focus on.
Mm-hmm. What are the true costs? I mean, it's certainly less than some of the alternatives out there, but why don't you give us a little bit of a rundown of what a typical network would face with trying to implement Linux?
Sure. So it's true, actually, that if you do a total cost of ownership analysis, that in many cases it can be cheap to implement Linux than other environments, whether they be Unix-style environments or Windows-style environments. And the reason for that is a couple of different reasons. One is there is the fact that you can acquire and deploy the actual operating system for free, but some of the other pieces that throw some of the lower cost of ownership elements are things like the ability to reuse hardware that you might have previously considered to not be good enough to run your environment and be able to reuse that. And also what I call the commodity ecosystem that exists around Linux and all of the other applications like the web services applications, mm-hmm. such as things like JBoss or the web server applications like Apache, all of those things tend to bring the cost much lower. Now, the other side of that coin, though, is that there are some increased costs that you can incur depending on your environment. So things like retraining the people that make up your environment. In fact, one of the issues around Linux on the desktop, as an example, is that it's not necessarily the issue of a lower cost operating system or lower cost application. Mm-hmm. It's actually the cost of retraining your entire population can actually increase the cost, and so it makes it difficult to justify some of the switches. So the point really is that there's absolutely an opportunity to lower your overall cost by deploying Linux in your environment, but it's not free. And that's really the gap we have to get folks to understand, is that it is not free, but it can be significantly lower cost.
One of the major hurdles that I've heard through the years with Linux is that it doesn't have a lot of support out there. And, you know, if there's smaller companies that are trying to roll this puppy out, and they have a hard time doing it because they're maybe used to Windows, which has a lot of support and a lot of documentation. Does that situation still exist with Linux?
So that's actually a great point. I think that over the years, that situation has gotten significantly better. And probably the key point around Linux is that you have a choice of support. And the choices do revolve around, for example, if you acquired your Linux distribution from a vendor like Red Hat or SUSE, you can get your support from those vendors. But you also can get your support from vendors like HP or IBM, examples as well. And then furthermore, there are companies that actually specialize in only providing support, so companies like LinuxCare. And then finally, if you're a very large enterprise and you have a really good, sophisticated IT staff, the option that's available to you that was really never available to you before is, in fact, self-support. Because you have access to the entire source space for Linux and many of its ancillary applications, you actually have the ability to fund your own support and really address your issues on your timeline. And that's one of the key new options that is not available in the proprietary world.
You talked about an aspect of this that I need to probably expand on, and that's the whole concept of being able to use older servers and things like that. How come Windows basically allows you to go back and use older equipment? I mean, is there a sacrifice to be had in performance when you do that, though?
There's two elements there. One is the choices that vendors, you know, such as Microsoft with Windows or other vendors with other operating environments will choose to only support a certain minimum configurations or a subset of configurations. So you're in many instances, and the point here, we shouldn't pick just on Microsoft with Windows. The same thing applies with other vendors and RISC and Unix, is that vendors make choices to say, we will no longer support this older hardware. So if you want support from HP, you now must upgrade, and here's your deadline to upgrade. Or if you want your support from IBM, here's your deadline, and here's when you must upgrade. So I'm trying to make sure I don't just pick on one particular company there.
Sure.
And so what happens with Linux is that those restrictions and situations really go away because you have the option and the opportunity of realistic self-support and these third-party companies that you can hire to also support your environment. You can actually use some much older configurations and have them supported. The other area which you mentioned, which is the area of performance, is that in many instances, Linux is actually a very small and very efficient operating system and operating environment, and is therefore uses much fewer resources in order to run. So for many applications, whether it be things like file print sharing or for a very simple web-serving application, a lot of times today people will deploy hardware that is far, far more than what they need for the application. And so this ability to sometimes reuse older hardware to really meet the needs of the application also has an aspect in the cost factor associated with it.
How does Linux actually save money based on using the lower powered hardware?
It's not necessarily the situation that Linux saves money because it deploys on lower-powered hardware. The way that you save money is in the ability to redeploy your hardware or to extend the life of the infrastructure you have. So as large customers look at their enterprise, they typically will allocate a certain life cycle to the hardware and the equipment they have. And in the boom times of the late 90s, they would actually roll to new hardware pretty frequently, and now that, you know, the economy has been a little bit more of a struggle for folks, they might have extended that life cycle. And by being able to extend the life cycle even further by using an environment like Linux, mm-hmm. it's an opportunity to spend money elsewhere, if you will, as opposed sure. to necessarily a direct lower cost.
Why would you say that Microsoft is so concerned about Linux?
There's, of course, a couple of different angles to that. So, obviously, they should be concerned because it's a competitor.
Yeah.
And as competitors, we have to be concerned about, you know, whatever other offerings might be available out there and need to compete vigorously. And that's not just unique to Microsoft, right?
Yeah.
So that's one aspect.
True.
The other aspect that Microsoft is concerned about is the intellectual property aspects associated with Linux and open source in general. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that Microsoft's business model and its history has really been built around they are uniquely a software supplier, yeah. and the entire value that they bring to customers is locked within the software that they give.
Mm-hmm.
Most other companies actually have either a mix of hardware and software, or they're not as tied to necessarily the operating system business per se. They're more in the applications business.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the issues there are less of a concern. And so by having something which is essentially free, it's open, and people can provide self-support, it opens up a new dynamic and a new style of competition mm-hmm. for Microsoft. So it's not just this is competitive to Microsoft's yeah. operating system business. It's also this new style of competition.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a normal market dynamic that, you know, we have to adapt to.
Well, let's talk more about your actual book. What inspired you to write the book? And I know that there's a lot of need out there for finding out about how to create business models. Was that really what drove it?
It was driven by actually the fact that I had this job within HP to drive an open source strategy throughout the company, a Linux and open source strategy. And as I was talking to both internal people, because Linux is fairly new, both yeah. internal to HP as well as to our customer base, I found myself essentially answering the same questions over and over again. They were good questions, but it was clear to me that there wasn't anything out there that I was able to point these folks to say, read this and you'll understand.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seemed that there was this gap in the marketplace where you could buy a whole bunch of Linux books that talk about the kernel or how to administrate it or about any of the open source applications. But the idea of what is Linux, what is open source, why do I care, how do I deploy it in my enterprise, and how do the business and economic factors change as a consequence of it? As far as I could tell at the time, that didn't exist as one consolidated piece of material.
Yeah, that certainly was the thing that really jumped out to me, was that I've never heard of a business and economics book on Linux. So that's what really made it pop for me. And it's good to see. I mean, I definitely like to see competition out there, especially with the operating system markets. And certainly companies need to understand how to make a business model work with it. What kind of reaction are you getting out there from the software people out there?
So far, all the reaction has been just beyond my wildest dreams. It's just been very positive. The developer community has very correctly recognized that I was not targeting them, that I was targeting the management audience. And so their reaction has been one of finally something I can give to my manager, to my management
yeah.
team to help them understand. And so that's been extremely positive. I've also received really good positive feedback from some of our customer population who have been saying, I hear about this Linux thing out there, and I don't know if it's right for me. I don't know if I should deploy it. You know, help me understand what that means. And so I've gotten some really good feedback as a consequence of that as well. So I've just been very, very pleased.
We have Martin Fink on the phone. Martin is the author of the book The Business and Economics of Linux and Open Source. He's helping us understand how Linux can be an economically viable competitor to Windows. We'll have more with Martin in a moment. This is WebTalkEyes Radio.
This is WebTalkEyes Radio. I'm Rob Greenlee, and that's Dana on the other mic.
And we're having a conversation with Martin Fink, both a Hewlett-Packard staffer and an author of The Business and Economics of Linux and Open Source.
So do you think we will see products like Lindows become really competitive out there? And, I mean, are we going to see that GUI actually develop as robust as what we're seeing with Windows as we look out in the future?
So I think with environments like Windows, I think the first thing that people are going to be concerned about is to make sure that the applications that they need to run in their homes, for example, do in fact run. And at least right now, Windows seems to have targeted more of a consumer mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what I struggle with is that while they're targeting consumers, much of the consumer applications, which are things like games and home finance, are not things for which there is a huge number of options on the Linux front, at least compared to on the commercial side, the number of commercially available mm-hmm. games and home finance applications. It may be that from a Windows for the consumer perspective, that that's probably going to be a little bit of a struggle. At least that's my perspective on it, because of the lack of applications targeted specifically at the consumer space. What I think it does do, though, is that it does show to the consumer and to the population in general, the whole cost of delivering their system to their home is that there is a cost of the hardware, there is a cost of the operating system, and it makes that visible so that people understand the value that they're paying for.
Mm-hmm. Over the next, I don't know, 5 or 6 years or so, will we see Windows-type products out there that are running on consumer desktops that people are able to get a wide variety of applications, just like what we're seeing right now with Windows?
That truly is the great debate. So on the desktop today, where we see most of the activity is for high-end engineering types of applications,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and we're seeing some uptake for what we call things like transactional desktops. So these are desktops for single purpose, like your retail console, you know, to hand out money in a store and things like that. And the place where we're seeing most of the desktop deployments of things like Linux, or whether it be Windows or other Linux distributions, is for non-Western countries. So for much of the developing world, third world countries or Eastern Bloc countries that do not have an infrastructure of Windows in their environment, that's where we see the deployments. The deployment of Linux for the general consumer, if that does happen, it's many, many years away.
Mm-hmm. It certainly seems like that there needs to be some competition out there for Windows, and it seems like Windows is those type of OS is the most likely yeah. candidate for that.
But let's also not forget about the Macintosh, and they've got
that's true.
They target the graphics artist niche as well. But so there are some other alternatives that customers can choose.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about Linux from the standpoint of what it does best. And certainly, Linux can be a great OS for a web server. Is there any downsides to using Linux as a web server?
Yeah, absolutely, you just hit the nail on the head. That is ground zero for Linux and some of the key applications around it, the web, mail, news, DNS, bind, all of those edge of the network internet applications is absolutely where Linux shines and does extremely well. There are proven deployments, proven business cases. Folks like Amazon have done that, Google and others. So there's real documented proof that it works well in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the other one that's, if you're within the Linux circles, you know this very well. If you don't live within the Linux circles, it seems to not be as well understood. But that's the file and print sharing capabilities through things like the Samba open source application. So one of the real cost-effective and really good deployments for Linux is for file and print sharing capabilities, and it does that extremely well, and that, too, is well proven.
Mm-hmm.
It's just been a little bit striking to see that one is somewhat less well-known outside of the Linux circle.
Do you have to hire specially trained people to be able to work on Linux, or can people that have backgrounds like with Unix or even Windows be able to pick it up pretty quick?
If your administrators have a background in Unix, then the transition to Linux is almost free. Because of the obvious sort of sensationalism associated with a little bit of a David and Goliath with Windows,
yeah.
You know, people have a tendency to look at Linux as a replacement for Windows. To be perfectly honest about it, where we see it is a lot of the replacement for a lot of the low-end Solaris deployments out there. The financial services industry is a prime example of that, where we see a huge number of customers looking at redeploying much of their Solaris infrastructure to Linux. And one of the big benefits of that is not just the lower cost, but it's that transition from a migration and training perspective that they can take their existing population of mm-hmm. administrators and they can very rapidly take over management of Linux.
Wow.
If your administrative population is in fact based and expert in the Windows environment, then the transition to Linux will be, it's a long curve. It would be analogous to moving from Windows to Unix. So it's a big curve. It's a lot of work and a lot of retraining. So it's much more difficult to do.
We're chatting with Martin Fink of Hewlett-Packard. He's just written a book, The Business and Economics of Linux and Open Source. We'll visit more with Martin on the other side, and you're listening to Web Talk Guys Radio.
You're still connected to the Web Talk Guys radio show. I'm Rob Greenlee, and Web Girl Dana's here.
Martin Fink is joining us today to discuss alternatives to Windows, and he's written a book, The Business and Economics of Linux and Open Source.
So do you see the open source movement moving towards a stronger business model, per se, over time? And I know that's the big issue around Linux and whatever is, it's been difficult for companies to come up with business models that actually generate revenue because everything's free. Do you see that kind of closing up, or is it going to maintain that free type of version out there? I mean, are we going to have all these different flavors that do specific things? Is that where this is going, that actually you would buy?
The community in general, if you talk about just the community of developers, really smart folks out there that are continuing to develop and enhance, they really don't have an economic driver. They're not doing this for the money. So the drivers for coming up with a valid business model doesn't come from the open source community. It comes from, you know, smart business people who are saying, I see an opportunity there. Now, how do I turn that opportunity into something that's revenue generating? And what we're seeing is a sort of normal market maturation to say, what are the various business model options and which ones will succeed? There are some business models which fail, and those that tend to be focused on purely this idea of packaging and selling something which is available for free and saying, I'm just going to put a little bit of support around it. Those are not proven business models from the perspective of being sustainable over time. The one that's been the most successful in that model so far has been Red Hat, and they worked very hard at it. But it's still, you know, we still have to look at it as a long-term sustainability. I think what we're seeing, though, is that this maturation is occurring, and what we're seeing is folks getting very creative about bundling open-source software with things like closed-source software in order to deliver a complete solution to the customer. And let me give you a perfect example of this, because this is actually a beautiful model. Zimian Corporation, they actually build this email front-end GUI for end users called Evolution. And if you're familiar with the Windows environment, it's very much like Outlook. It's a mail calendaring thing. But what happens is that they have this piece they call the connector that allows you to connect this Evolution front-end to a Microsoft Exchange server. This connector that links those two is something they charge money for. It's proprietary software. But from a customer perspective, the customer can say, I can take just the Evolution part and I have some degree of functionality at a very low or no cost. But if I want to integrate it into my enterprise, there's this piece called a connector I have to buy, and that becomes Zimian's business model. Uh-huh. And I think this type of combined open source and proprietary software is most likely the type of business model that will survive over the long term. I think the idea that, like, there are some, you know, let's call them zealots out there who believe all software in all of its forms should be absolutely free and open. And at least from my perspective, living in this in the business world, I don't think that's a realistic or even sustainable model over the long haul.
So what you're saying, it seems like, is what we're going to see is applications that are sold as complete solutions, but they've integrated Linux into it, so maybe they can just install that particular application directly onto the computer without having to have a preloaded operating system there and just kind of bundling it all together. Was that kind of what you're saying?
That's probably stretching the model a little bit. Most times you need to have a base operating system there. Probably a simpler model would be something along the lines of closed proprietary applications that run on top of the open operating system.
Okay.
And a good example there is Oracle. Mm-hmm. So Oracle runs on Linux, but you buy Oracle for Linux much like you would buy Oracle for Windows or for Unix. And so it's a proprietary application taking advantage of an open source operating system.
Now, doesn't 9i actually, you can actually install that directly into a server without an operating system, I thought.
That's news to me.
Okay. I mean, heard that you don't even have to have an operating system to run the 9i software. I'm just wondering if they're loading the operating system in with the application, I guess, is where my core question is. And is that going to happen over time?
So that's not something that I see happening. And okay. The reason being that the operating system is a dependency from multiple applications. And so therefore, you have a situation where a customer needs to be able to have one operating system and then load multiple applications onto that operating system.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
So that type of bundling, I think, only for very specialized vertical applications where that might happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, where can our listeners find your book?
Pretty much almost all the bookstores, at least online. So Amazon.com, mm-hmm. BarnesandNoble.com. Apprentice Hall is the publisher, so the Apprentice Hall website also has it listed. I've actually, caught it in a few bookstores around a few different places around the country, which is kind of cool, too.
Terrific. Well, Martin, thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you. It was an absolute pleasure.
It's fantastic hearing all about your new book on Linux out there. It's definitely needed. We've been speaking with Martin Fink, who's the author of The Business and Economics of Linux and Open Source. Martin has given us a real glimpse into how Linux is changing the landscape of software out there. So, Martin, take care, and you have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks.
Be sure and stay connected to WebTalkGuys Radio, because on the other side, we'll be finding out how you can save on the cost of those inkjet printer cartridges when we speak with Larry Letart of InkSaver.com. This is WebTalkGuys Radio. Hey, do you love the internet and media? Are you interested in implementing streaming media into your business? Or maybe you just want to create your own entertainment empire? Well, the WebTalkGuys are offering a one-day hands-on workshop covering everything about streaming audio and video and how you can encode using real audio and video, Windows media, and MP3. You'll learn all the steps from concept to production to the final webcast, and you can turn it all into your own radio show or a way to market your expertise on the internet or take your business online. This one-day workshop on streaming media production is Tuesday, January 14, from 9 to 4. The workshop is held at the Tacoma Community College's Downtown Center in Tacoma, Washington. You can register by calling Tacoma Community College or going online to their website. You can get more information right at our WebTalkGuys website at webtalkguys.com/workshop. And keep this in mind, two more one-day workshops from the WebTalkGuys are coming up very soon. We're going to be teaching a website usability techniques workshop on February 11, also at the TCC Downtown Center, and a website marketing and promotions one-day workshop on March 18. Remember, more information at webtalkguys.com/workshop. We'd love to meet you and see you there.
And now, the Internet's future. The WebTalkGuys.
Thanks for listening to WebTalkGuys Radio. This is WebGirl Dana. Well, periodically, I want to take a look at some interesting software that has come our way at the WebTalkGuys studio. Software that's going to help us be more productive and, of course, save us money, the ever-popular reason. And just such a solution came across my desk a few weeks ago from Strident Software. They produce InkSaver, and you can look them up at InkSaver.com. And the ink we're talking about is that very expensive, worth its weight in gold, inkjet cartridge that you have to buy every 6 months or so to keep your printer happy. But that darn little cartridge, the black one or the color one, it doesn't matter, seemed to cost as much as the printer itself. And since we're all slaves to our printers, if you have an inkjet, you're one of, I think, 60 million that are sold each year worldwide, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, while it seems like there's really no profit margin on printers themselves because they're so inexpensive, they make up for it on those cartridges. Well, InkSaver is a little different from what you might think, these refillable toolkits, etc. No, this is a piece of software that controls how much ink is laid down on the page. And here to tell us all about it is Larry Letart. He's the product manager over at Strident Software, the makers of InkSaver.com. They're in British Columbia. Hey, Larry, thanks for calling in from across the border. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's set the stage. We're out looking for a printer, and many of us have seen that ad circular where you can get a printer for $49.95 or something like that. And, you know, I mean, how could you go wrong with that? So, Larry, I think you have an idea of how we can go wrong with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why don't you tell us the true cost of what printers are?
You're exactly right. When you go out there looking for a new inkjet printer these days, you're going to see them really inexpensive. You're going to see $49 printers, $99 printers. And in some cases, you know, if you buy a new PC or something like that, they're just going to give you the printer for free. What consumers are generally not aware of, however, when they make that purchase is the cost of the consumables, which would be primarily the ink cartridges to run that printer. Our research shows that the typical user is going to use somewhere between 3 and 4 cartridges a year, especially on the less expensive lower-end printers. Those cartridges are approaching the price of the printer itself. So if you go out and buy that $49 printer, you're going to find yourself in a couple months back in the store spending $40, $50 for ink to keep that printer running, and you're going to be doing that a few times a year. So your real costs are hidden at the time of purchase.
And, you know, you count yourself lucky if the printer actually comes with a cartridge installed.
Yeah, you know, more and more they're either not including a cartridge or just including a, you know, a black cartridge and not including a color, or HP, for example, has used this term economy cartridge occasionally. And what that really is a cartridge that doesn't have very much ink in it. So you'll find yourself at the store pretty quickly once you buy that printer.
So printer companies are selling a lot of printers at that low price and really probably not making much of a profit margin. What are some of the statistics on the printer industry as far as what they're selling?
Yeah, I mean, it really is a, you know, sort of the traditional razor and razor blade model. The printer industry is a huge industry. The projections are that by next year, there will be 115 million inkjet printers just in the U.S. Worldwide inkjet printer revenue was about $12 billion in the year 2000. Ink cartridge revenue is actually higher than that at this point. It's, I think, somewhere between $15 and $17 billion for this year. And so what you're seeing is that the manufacturers are getting those printers out there as inexpensively as they can so that they can capture the highly profitable inkjet cartridge money. You know, when you look at HP's financial reports, for example, you'll see that their printing division, more than 60% of its profits are generated from the consumables, from selling the ink and from selling the paper for those printers.
Do you have any idea of what the profit margin is on ink? It can't be $35 for a little bit of ink. I bought a ballpoint pen that has that much ink.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head the exact margin, but, you know, as you say, it's quite a healthy margin for sure.
Yeah. I was really taken aback in reading some material that you have on your website to find this sort of devious practice, it seems, that the printer industry is imposing upon us. Why don't you tell us about this computer chip thing?
Yeah, so the chips are really quite interesting. In the last few years, the printer manufacturers have started putting chips right on the ink cartridge itself. And they market this to the consumer as a benefit, right, that it enables them to tell you more about, say, the ink levels in the cartridge or, you know, the life of the cartridge when it's ready to expire and things like that. But at the same time, what they're able to do is they're able to use that chip on the cartridge to do things like control the type of cartridge that can be used in the printer. So, for example, if you buy a third-party cartridge and put it in and that cartridge doesn't have the chip on it or doesn't have the right type of chip on it, the printer may not be willing to print for you.
Oh, my goodness.
Or it may be give you a message that says, you're not using the proper cartridge. This could result in low quality, you know, printing or, you know, damage to your printer. So,
meanwhile, you've purchased a third party printer cartridge. You can't return it, and you get scared, so you have to go out and buy this company's cartridge.
Exactly. So they're basically using it as a way to funnel your money into their pockets on the ink purchase.
And there's something about maybe it doesn't let you print after a certain, like a certain level, certain low level.
Yeah,
it doesn't let you refill it? Somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of things that those cartridges with the chips on them can do. It will tell you when you don't have enough ink left to have a good quality print out. You know, maybe it's not quite out of ink. It will have a date programmed into it that is an expiration date for that cartridge. So if you buy a few cartridges and you don't print as much as you think you are going to, you may put that third cartridge in and find that it's been expired in the chip itself. You don't get a chance to actually find out if the ink itself is expired. Or you may find that it's telling you, hey, you know, you're not going to get a good quality printout after this particular date or particular point in the cartridge's life.
So could you tell us some of these manufacturers, Larry? We want to know.
Well, you know, HP in particular is putting chips on all of their cartridges at this point. I believe believe Lexmark is also using a chip. And their story on it is that they're mainly trying to get the consumer to use their cartridges and then sort of put them back in their system so they can reclaim them from the waste cycle. But again, they're really trying to limit the amount of third-party availability of cartridges out there.
You know, I can attest to that with a Lexmark that my father has, and he's an infrequent printer and probably got 20 pages out of it over a lengthy period of time, and supposedly it dried up. That's what customer support told him, so I think it expired. They made him go buy a new one. What does InkSaver do? Why don't you tell us a little bit about your solution to this dilemma?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as we've been talking about, right, this cost of printing is a huge problem for consumers. We as a company, Strident Software, has been in the printing industry for a long time. We have a lot of expertise. And when we were getting ready to develop this product, we did a lot of customer research and found that customers are generally happy with the way their inkjet works, but it's too expensive. And we thought, how can we address this problem? So we went out and we addressed it with a product that is actually a software product that lets you control the amount of ink that gets put down on the page. That's relatively unique. There isn't really anything else out there like this. It's a very easy-to-use piece of software. You install it onto your machine, and we have, you know, a very simple interface that lets you control the amount of black ink and the amount of color ink that is put down on the page for each print job. And otherwise, you just interact with your applications and with your printing as you normally would. We don't replace your driver. You know, we're not adding complicated preferences to that print dialog that you see when you pop up. It's simply we have this little icon in your taskbar that you can go in and adjust your percentage of ink savings and forget about it, or you can have it ask you to, you know, set that savings each time.
Now, is this different than the draft mode that some of us like to print in when we're just doing black and white documents?
Yeah, it is actually. It's quite a bit different than draft mode. There's a couple key things to know about draft mode. It's been around for a long time, and really what it was designed for is to increase your print speed rather than to save you ink when you print. So it's less a factor now for print speed, but you'll remember back in the days when, you know, it took a minute to print off a page from an inkjet printer or something like that. You'd go and select draft mode to get that page out so that when you're printing that 10-page document, you're not sitting there for 5 minutes. So what it's basically doing is it's sort of spraying ink onto the page as quickly as it can to get that print job through. Now, it does end up saving a little bit of ink, but you get a pretty low-quality document. InkSaver, on the other hand, is pretty much specifically designed to save ink in as efficient a way as possible and to preserve as much of your print quality as possible. So when your print job comes through to the printer, we sort of grab it halfway through, look at it, sort of intelligently scan the print job, and remove ink where we can while maintaining a high level of print quality.
So how does that work? How do you remove the ink, or how does it decide to remove what part of the ink?
If you think about it conceptually, you can sort of think of when you hit print on a application, right, Microsoft Word or something like that, Microsoft Word works with the printer driver to create a print job. And so if you think of the print job as this bundle of information working its way to the printer, we sort of grab that bundle of information, we open it up, and we're able to interpret what that document is going to look like. And we basically do sort of a line-by-line scan of that image. And using some patent-pending algorithms we've developed, we're able to say, okay, where can we remove individual dots that aren't going to really be visible to the naked eye when you have that output on a page?
Okay. Does InkSaver work with all kinds of printers? And you know, sometimes you want to use these refill kits and everything. Does that interfere at all with that?
Yeah, sure. That's a good question. To answer the second part first, InkSaver works with any type of ink you may use. So you can use a refill kit, you can use a third-party cartridge, or you can use your printer manufacturer's cartridge. In terms of compatibility, we're in our first release of the product, and we've initially launched with wide support for Hewlett-Packard, Epson, and Canon inkjet printers. So we think we've got about 80% of the inkjet market covered in North America right now. We're constantly adding support for printers as we go through the development cycle. And, you know, we're always encouraging people to check our website for updates if they see our package in the store and it doesn't yet have their printer.
We're talking about the high cost of inkjet printing and those tiny little cartridges with a big price tag with Larry Letarte. He's the product manager over at Strident Software. They're in British Columbia, Canada, and they represent InkSaver, a lovely little piece of software that will take care of cutting your inkjet ink consumption about in half. We'll have more from InkSaver in a second. This is Web Talk Guys Radio. This is an Online Minute with Trey Hickman. He's president and founder of Nextology. Today we're discussing online catalogs. Nextology has developed a software called Next Inventory. Trey, why don't you tell us a little bit about this application?
Sure. Next Inventory is a web-based catalog management system. It doesn't require any technical expertise other than knowing how to get on the internet.
Who is the best candidate for Next Inventory?
Well, it was designed for business owners who need to constantly update products that are displayed online, but who don't necessarily have the budget for a full-time IT staff.
Tell us a little bit about the tool's capabilities.
Well, Next Inventory allows you to add, edit, delete unlimited product information in real time without programming. And Next Inventory provides built-in search functionality.
So is this an e-commerce system?
Well, this is an important distinction. Next Inventory can just manage an online catalog, or it can easily integrate into an online credit card processing system for optional e-commerce capabilities.
Thank you, Trey. For more information about Nextology's solutions for online content management, call them at area code 312-644-0059 or visit them online at www.nextology.com.
The Web Talk Guys, here and now.
Thanks for hanging with us. This is Web Talk Guys Radio. I'm Dana Greenlee, taking you down a little software product review excursion. We here at Web Talk Guys recently received a nice little piece of software called InkSaver, and it's from Strident Software. And we have on the phone with us Larry Letart. He's the product manager over at InkSaver. Okay, Larry, let's get to the bottom line. I want to know how much I can save if I use InkSaver, just a ballpark. And I know that it depends on what degree I choose to print at.
Exactly. We give the user the option to set their savings from 0 to 75%. And what we're seeing is that typically you're going to probably save 25 to 50%. I, in the office, use about a 45% setting on just about every document that I print, and I'm pretty happy with the output. And, you know, that 45% translates into basically doubling the life of the cartridge. Mm-hmm. Like I said, you know, individual user preferences will vary. Some people may choose to save a little less. Some people, for example, you know, home users with kids who are doing a lot of printing may crank it all the way up to 75%, and they'll really be tripling, quadrupling the life of their cartridge.
Well, yeah, you mentioned earlier that we could buy up to 4 cartridges a year, so there's half of that would be $70 that you save a year, perhaps, something like that.
Yeah, exactly. If you set InkSaver at a pretty moderate level, you're going to have it pay for itself in 1 or 2 cartridges.
Yeah. Now, you guys actually took it to a third-party testing lab. What were those findings?
Basically, we took it to a third-party testing lab to verify that what we're saying about the product is actually true, and we asked them to look at a couple of key things. One is, you know, when we tell the user that they're saving 25%, when they select 25%, do they actually get 25% more output? And mm-hmm. the findings were that, well, yes, in fact, they do within, you know, a very small degree of variance, you know, 24.5% to 25.5%, something like that. The second thing we asked them to do was look at the actual quality of the print jobs that are coming out and help us decide where good, acceptable levels of printing are. You know, they found in general that you could save a fair amount of ink on most print jobs and still get what they called an acceptable level of quality. Now, obviously, when you're printing a photo, you're going to have a lower level of ink savings before you start to notice there's a reduction in quality compared to, say, a text document or, you know, mm-hmm. a business graphic or something like that. But we were quite pleased with the results.
You've passed some of the product reviews in the various, like, PC Magazine and such. So that's all good news.
Yeah, we're very excited. We're getting a lot of buzz out there in the marketplace, and people are really aware of problems with the cost of consumables, and we're happy to see that, you know, publications like PC Magazine are recognizing it, that people are interested in talking to us and really excited about the product.
Larry, your website at inksaver.com, by the way, offers some other non-software-related tips and tricks that you can use to lower your printing costs. Can you run down a few of those for us?
Yeah, sure. We on our website have a printer information center that basically is a resource for consumers looking to, you know, further reduce the cost of printing. There are, you know, a number of things that users can do in addition to using InkSaver to reduce the cost of printing. Most inkjet printers these days have a duplex mode built in. You can use duplex to print on both sides of the sheet. You can also use the layout functionality built into the driver. Sometimes you have to dig for some of these driver functions, but mm-hmm. you know, if you're printing a long document just for proofing, you can do, you know, two pages or 4 pages per sheet of paper and, you know, really save on the amount of ink and on the amount of paper you're using. So it's little tricks like that that can help control the cost.
Good. And Larry, in the last minute or so, why don't you run down some of the particulars and details about InkSaver, where we can get it, where your company is located, and how much?
Yeah, the company is located in Vancouver, British Columbia, Strident Software. You can get InkSaver directly from us at www.inksaver.com. We're also available nationwide in the U.S. at CompUSA's and in regional chains, for example, Fry's in the San Francisco and Los Angeles areas in California. We're always looking to expand our distribution. Of course, you can get it on other websites as well, Amazon.com, Buy.com. And the price is $34.99.
Good deal, and you'll make that back in the first few months, I think.
You certainly will.
We've been speaking with Larry Letarte. He's the product manager at Strident Software, the makers of InkSaver. And I've been using this software for a few weeks now, so I can attest that images look good. Thanks, Larry, for giving us some insight into what's going on with those ink prices.
Thanks for having me on, Dana.
Have a good weekend. This is Web Talk Guys Radio, and that's it for this week. We sure do appreciate you letting us into your ears during the last hour.
Remember, the Web Talk Guys is streamed via the internet 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, so you can always get it right here.
Yeah, and if you missed part of the show, well, we have each segment separately available for listening when it's convenient for you. And we'd like to thank all our friends down at CNET Radio, at XM Satellite, XSVoice.com, and our great sponsors. And of course, a big thanks to you, Rob, our host.
And thank you too, Dana. Dana's also our terrific show engineer. And we'd also like to thank you for being a loyal listener and hope to see you again next week. We'll see you around the net.
Thank you for downloading the Web Talk Guys. Bookmark us now for next week. Same Web Talk Guys time, same Web Talk Guys channel.